Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. And now, enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today on Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about secret rules in D&D and other role-playing games. Does it add to immersion and flexibility for the GM? Is it fair or is it unfair? Should players knowing rules be prohibited? All that and more today on Wandering DMs.
Before we get into telling you all the things you shouldn't tell your players, let me remind you all and take this opportunity to tell you that at the end of this show, we'll be hosting our after-party chat. That's a live video chat with Dan and I for about an hour after the end of this show, so about a little after 2 p.m. Eastern time, we'll be on our Discord server hosting our after-party chat. And you can join in. To do so, just join our Patreon at patreon.com/wanderingdms. Join at any tier level. You'll get an invite to our Discord server, and you can jump on in at 2 o'clock Eastern for our after-party chat.
We hope you'll be there. We love that part of our Sunday all the time. So, Paul, I sort of suggested this secret rules idea here today for a couple of reasons. There's a little bit of a confluence for me. As I've said a couple times recently on the show, I'm currently running a Star Frontiers campaign, the science fiction game from the 80s from the makers of D&D, and kind of just a kind of palate cleanser, probably different system. And I've accidentally run into the issue that I didn't have the time or interest to tell the players where they could find the rules. And of course, it's out of print and it's unpublished and they can't actually, you know, there's no directly feasible legal way for them to get it anywhere. And I just completely accidentally stumbled into this situation where we're gaming and the players completely don't know the rules whatsoever. And a lot of the times, neither do I, because I haven't remembered it. And so we get into some situations and I, as the GM, as the referee, either have to look it up and go, oh, that's how that's going to happen. Oh, okay. Or have to just ad lib, have to improvise something on the fly. Mm. Secondly, as I've said a couple times recently, I have been reading the rather influential in some circles, Peter Perla's The Art of Wargaming from 1990. I just finished that this weekend. And, you know, it's all about wargaming. And in particular, Perla himself actually worked at the U.S. Navy. And so a lot of the focus is on professional usage in the actual Defense Department for wargaming. And then what I discovered is right at the end of the book, it weirdly pivots into a whole bunch of role-playing stuff.
Oh,
and among, right? Greatly to my surprise. And among the interesting observations is a rather large emphasis on reducing the amount of information the players have to not break the spell of the immersion. And, you know, it's something that I've considered, I think, in the past from time to time, whether I should go more in that direction. And here I am accidentally having it happen at my game table and accidentally running into this advice about it. And it's I'm finding a lot of really interesting, playful aspects to the players not knowing the rules.
Fascinating. It's a very authentic way to play, I think, to the very earliest versions of the game, right? Because you hear all these recountings of the way the game was played in the very early days when frankly, you know, there was nothing published, right? They were clearly just making it up as they were going. I'm thinking specifically of like the Brownstein games, right? From which I got to play one with Wesley
It was Gary Con.
Yeah, a little while back. And that, right, the famously that sort of like a lot of people say that's the beginning of role play, right? And that's, they were specifically sitting down to play a war game and they had all the miniatures laid out. And David Wesley said, before we begin, you know, we're going to do this thing where we take on these roles and we're going to do this little like pre-game thing just to figure out what the setup of the war game will be like. And then they, of course, never got to the war game. And it's very so, but it's consistent based on what I've heard of accounts of what that was like, and then have actually played a recreation of that game with him. That like, yeah, you're not really handed anything. There's no rules. There's no nothing. Right? You get a description, right, like a paragraph about who your character is, and go. Good luck.
Right. Right. Yep. That seems very. Go ahead.
I was going to say, and then we've debated, you and I think, we've tried to dig up evidence of how much was kept behind the screen as the game progressed. And specifically, I know that there's anecdotes about first edition D&D, right, being played, or AD&D, being played this way, where the DM is making all the roles, and that's, you know, the players are just don't really know, right, don't understand or don't have to understand how the mechanics are applied.
I find myself going back to, I think it's like the third page of original D&D of you can have characters, you can have ability scores. And what it actually says there is the referee rolls the ability scores for the player characters, like, and then in order to inform the players about their choices going forward. So clearly in that particular case, the statistics would be visible to the players, but it does seem to set the tendency, the assumption that the DM's rolling all the dice, even in that, like creating your character situation. So it seems like that may have been actually happening.
Yeah. I mean, we know people have reported playing that way. I know, like, kind of famously Dan Harmon, I think, has talked about that. I can't remember if this came up or not in our interview with Spencer Crittenden a while back, but I think so. And I think he maybe mentioned, or I heard Dan Harmon talk about this somewhere at some point. I can't recall, but you see the evidence of it in the D&D episodes of Community, where the DM is rolling all of the dice. And I'm pretty sure that maybe on his podcast, maybe that's where it was. I think on his podcast, Harmon has talked about, yeah, that's just how we played. The DM just rolled all the dice. That's how we did it. And there's, you know, there's things that back this up, like the fact that all of the attack matrices only exist in the Dungeon Master's Guide, right? If you just have the player's handbook, you do not have the rules at your fingertips for how to make an attack. It's not there.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. So that's kind of a standout example of in first edition AD&D. Yeah, all the combat tables, the hit tables, the saving throws, the turning table, the assassination table are all in the DM's guide. And the preface to that book specifically says, do not allow players to read this book. So it is the specific core mechanics are specifically walled off like that and allegedly unavailable to non-DMs. Now, we can poke holes about whether that's actually really viable or not, but that seemed to be the intent in first edition, absolutely. And things have definitely moved in the opposite direction from that.
Yeah. I think you still had, you know, obviously the player's handbook tells you how to make a character. It tells you about the stats required. So you have a character sheet with the stats in front of you. So you have some sense, right? You can look at numbers and say, well, my strength is very high and my intelligence is very low. So therefore I should try to do more physical things.
Right.
Right. But then how that boils into dice rolls. Yeah. It's just missing.
And I will say this. Okay. So like in first edition AD&D, it very clearly says, okay, we have the combat tables here in the DM's guide. Players are not permitted to read the DM's guide, but you know what? It doesn't explain why. It doesn't give you a motivation for why they made that decision. And you know what? If you look back at original D&D, the combat tables were in the player's book, they moved it and they actually didn't say why.
Yeah. And it's fascinating to think about like whether or not this was intentional or just happenstance, right? It was pointed out by Kevin Thompson in our chat just now, that dice supply was short, right? It was ridiculous in the early days to expect every player to own dice, right? And good certainly point. You know, you can see how in like when Gary and Dave Arneson were running the game in the early playtest days pre-publication, of course the players didn't have the rules. Of course not. They didn't exist. Right, they were figuring them out as they went. They were working off of notes, right? So of course that's how they played.
Yeah. Or even a little bit later, difficult to even when they were published, difficult to get the rules. There were You know, it was difficult to, you couldn't, it was, you had to custom order it. It was in limited supply. Photocopiers were hard to come by at the time. And there were reports about people going way, way out of their ways, highly challenging and difficult to get a copy of the rules, even if you wanted it, even if you were permitted that.
Yeah. So the question then, Dan, is, regardless of whether it was intentional or not, was it good, right? Is this a positive effect on gameplay? Or is the fact that we have migrated away from that evidence that, no, you want to arm your players with the rules? So tell me, what's your experience been like running Star Frontiers for a group of players who have no access to the rules?
I've really liked it. And I feel that, again, this being totally accidental, and I think it took me, you know, like, specifically picking up a different system as a bit of a palate cleanser, and thinking that it was going to be less impact on me as a DM, and oh my goodness, am I wrong about that? But anyway, it's been a really breath of fresh air of the things that we're talking about are diegetic. There are things that the player characters can witness in the world around them, and we're getting hung up so much less, I think, on the mechanics of what's this rule, what's this feat, what's this feature, how does this interact with that. Of there aren't a whole lot of complicated, like, network effects in the game. Speaking for myself and my players, we mostly have to fall back to how do we think things would actually work in this game situation, and we might have a little bit of a negotiation about that a little bit. So I do think that it has really increased the immersion, and it's forced both of us, both sides, to really think about the reality of the fiction more so than getting hung up on a bunch of mechanics that we can possibly debate about. And, you know, just you and I, Paul, we both certainly had some players that will, you know, dispute rules. Okay. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not everybody. And there's, you know, reasonable points to that. And I have gently done that sometimes in the past myself. But if the players don't actually have knowledge of the specific mechanical rules, then that goes away. Those kinds of debates are just off the table. And there does have to be a certain amount of trust that the referee is, you know, playing fair and not just trying to beat up on players, obviously. So there's a higher level of trust involved. I think my players basically trust me to make fair rulings. But I have, you know, I have a referee screen with, you know, and on the outside of it, the players can see, like, equipment lists, available equipment and costs, and there's an XP table for where they can spend the experience that they get. There's a movement table, things like that. But all of the, like, chances, probabilities to hit combat tables, skill chances, all that kind of stuff is on the inside of the DM screen. Only I can see it. And I'm finding that it really has been increasingly immersion, I think, for both of us.
That makes a lot of sense to me. I feel like, you know, this goes back to, I think, one of the things I often say about playing with new players. I always get this response that somebody's never played before. They're like, oh, I don't know if I should play or not. You're probably going to be frustrated because I don't know how the game works at all. And I say, no, quite the opposite. I love playing with new players. And the quote that I've kind of crafted over time that I say all the time now is, I love that new players are unencumbered by knowledge of the rules, right? Yeah. So that, like, right. And this kind of, you know, okay, I'm gonna keep referencing this. It's hilarious, right? We kept, you know, a couple of weeks ago, we did an episode on skills, and amusingly, ever since then, I think every time I've back referenced that show, but it's one of my problems with skill systems. Is that by putting on the character sheet this list of skills and numbers showing you which skills you're good at, which skills you're not good at, right? It pigeonholes the player's thought process into specific actions, right? And that's what I'm getting at by being unencumbered by a knowledge of the rules. You don't know how the game works. Therefore, you're more inclined to just interact with the setting, with the act, with the action that's happening. And just imagine, and increase that immersive quality and just imagine what you would like to happen and speak and say, oh, how I would like blah, blah, blah. I would like to do this thing. How does that work? And then rely on the DM or other players to help you.
I'm going to grab my referee screen here. So this is my Star Frontiers referee screen that I play with. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you an interesting little, again, happy accident that happens with just the way that this game is set up that you might just consider how you could possibly use in other games is that when the players make their characters, they pick skills and they're very roughly grade. Okay, so someone can pick level 1 in medical skill. Okay, great. That's on their sheet. Now, mm-hmm. what's not on their sheet in this game is that the medical skill has a whole bunch of separate sub-skills that you could almost think like D&D thief skills. So every medical officer has the capacity to try like half a dozen or more specific tasks. And all that's currently hidden from the players. It's on the inside of my screen. And the players have no idea what the specific success chances are on any of this stuff. Or even that these subskills exist, frankly. So when they go to like, oh, I just got bitten by a possibly poisoned flying monster, they go, can I determine whether this was a poison bite or not? And then I have to come over on my end, look at the subskills and look at, okay, is this administer drugs, control infection, cure disease, diagnosis, or first aid? And they all have different percentages of success. Mm. And so it's this really interesting thing of they can't get distracted by this bunch of stuff on their sheet, like you're talking about, Paul, for the skills, because it's not on their sheet. But I have it over here, and I'm the one that has to look at, once they make the in-character, in-world decision, I'm the one that has to look at the details about what the mechanics are and then report back what their success chance is. And again, totally by accident, but that is exactly one of the ways where they just don't have that list of bunch of stuff on their sheet to distract them.
Fascinating. Fascinating. Let's talk about the other side of the coin, right? Let's talk about, I mean, again, so far our argument sounds like this is a wonderful idea and you should absolutely do it.
Absolutely.
And never tell your players the rules again.
Right, we're done. Right. All right, see you next week, everybody.
Yep. But I just think I just saw scroll by on the chat the comment of like, what about, or something along the lines of, you know, what about, dispersing the load, right, across the table, right? And we've talked about this, I think, on the show before of, you know, what kind of tasks as DM can you unload on your players so that you're not constantly under the gun to do everything? Now, this sounds like the opposite of that. This sounds like, nope, the players do nothing, and the DM must do absolutely every task, all of the work, 100% falls on the shoulders of the DM. That sounds exhausting.
I find it exhilarating. I personally find it to be an exhilarating challenge, and I feel like this is why I started DMing in the first place, is it pushes all my buttons, and, you know, as computer game guys, Paul, we know that in that particular field of engineering, we're going to use up all the computer. We're going to use up all the CPU, and we're going to use up all the memory. And the challenge is to fit as much stuff as we want in there. And I like having my CPU run at full capacity. Frankly, I do kind of get excited about it. But I need a simple system, right? So I cannot have. No one's going to be able to run an overly elaborate system. And I think by modern standards, Star Frontiers is pretty simple. And I think when I've said out in public that I was going to run Star Frontiers, a number of people, you know, immediately said, well, if you're running science fiction, why aren't you doing Traveler? Why not Traveler? Why not something? And I think one of the criticisms was Star Frontiers is overly simple. Only, you know, kids would want to do something like that. But it makes it feasible for me to largely hide all the mechanics from the players and do most of it in my own head. I will say that when we started out, one of the players hadn't ever played a game that was based on percentiles. So the very first thing that happened, I said, you know, in order to do this task, you have a 40% chance of success. And this player, the very first thing that she said was, oh, This whole game is just a trick to get Dan to make us do math. And although I was kind of amused, I said, you know, I'm the one doing all the math over here. What you're going to see is I'm actually doing a whole bunch of math and arithmetic on my side, and I'm just reporting a number back to you, and you just roll, is what happens. So, interestingly, their first instinct was it looked like the opposite of what you're saying there, Paul. But no, the truth is, I'm actually doing quite a bit of arithmetic, removing all of the math from the player side.
I mean, it's interesting to me that you brought up that you still ask them to roll, that you ultimately give them a number and say, roll this number, right? Yes. Which I think we both like. We like the idea of players knowing the stakes and players being able to, like, implement, right, the random number generation so that they're, right, even though we just talked about how, like, in the very beginning of this, that possibly there was some precedent of the DM rolls all the dice, we actually both, I think, prefer to make the players roll the dice with a foreknowledge of what the risk is going to be, which feels a little contrary to this. In fact, I feel like I can go back to arguments you've made before about things like, say, wandering monster checks, where you very specifically tell your players exactly what the rule is and then make them implement it.
I might have said that last week. I might have said that last Sunday, Paul.
So when is it fun to hide the rules and when is it fun to expose them to them?
I had to sit down and meditate this morning about whether I was being wildly contradictory, specifically with the players still rolling the dice aspect. And I think I've come up with a reasonably convincing defense about why it's still okay. But for that, I'm going to have to turn to Mr. Pearl, and I'm going to have to read you a whole bunch of text, Paul.
All right. Well, make sure you read it for the sake of our listeners who are listening to this in podcast and can't see the giant wall of text I'm about to put up on the screen. Yeah. You want to start at the beginning here, Dan?
Yes, please. So, again, here I am reading, finishing this weekend, Peter Perla's Art of Wargaming, and he's writing in 1990, and here I am almost at the end of the book. I think this is the last chapter or the second to last chapter or something like that. And so, he's discussed designing, developing war games in separate chapters, and now we're in the chapter on playing war games. And what he starts off with in this chapter is he starts talking about role-playing, much to my surprise. And what he says there in the first paragraph, he says, there's been something of a debate in the gaming hobby about whether players of war games, particularly historical board games, should be cast in the roles of specific real-life decision makers. Some of the disagreement is sparked by the existence of what is known as the fantasy role-playing hobby, represented by its most notorious example, the games known collectively as Dungeons and Dragons. The most notorious
example.
I love
that phrasing, the games collectively known as.
Right?
Not wrong. Right? Not wrong.
He's not wrong at all, right? He's very observant about that. The self-styled real war gamers, who are often aficionados of the study of military history or technical minutiae, sometimes feel uncomfortable if they are referred to in the same breath as their eccentric cousins, whose concerns center on the characteristics and fighting power of elves and goblins. And to be clear, these are central characters in most fantasy gaming. Right? Oh, but goodness. But if we go to the next, page, actually, so he says here, he points to well-respected historical board game designers, and I apologize, my scans didn't all come out perfectly clear here. So he's referring to Frank Chadwick of Game Designers Workshop, who's argued that, quote, all historical-based games are role-playing games. Which is a really, really interesting argument that basically all war games are role-playing games inherently. And in the past few years, there's been a bit of a debate about the two approaches. Nichols Games make use of what he calls the viewpoint-oriented approach, and I think we could call that the role-playing approach, in which the player's knowledge and control over the situation is restricted to as accurate a representation of the limitations of real world, and here he's talking about command, as the game's devisers can devise. So here he is talking about, and in other pages, he talks about the debate in wargaming between what we might call, are you in command or are you in control? of, in that particular perspective, is the game trying to inculcate a particular existence of, I'm in the role of General Patton, and I see and I get the information and I give orders and I get the effects that General Patton would have, or am I moving tanks on a board and do I have full control over every single step all the tanks make? Am I controlling all the units or am I commanding all the units? And those are two very different strategies for designing a war game. And he kind of goes into more detail about that, particularly Chadwick's perspective of, I'm really doing everything I possibly can to make the player feel like they're in the boots of a particular personality and confronting the same decisions. And at one point, Chadwick says, unfortunately, he says, I think that the command everything strategy is more marketable. And I actually think that more games are going to be, you know, showing, giving complete control of all the mechanics of the player. And actually, it's going to be a hard sell going forward to make war games that do try to represent a particular role. Which is, and then, you know, Perla says, I try to be more optimistic than that, but he, you know, he, Chadwick might be possibly right. And then there's this interesting paragraph here a little later that says, the most difficult time for players and control staff, for that matter, which is the equivalent of judges, the most difficult time for players and control staff to keep their roles usually occurs when control reports the results of damage assessment. And again, he's kind of in the situation of simulation at the Navy, where you've got a team doing some kind of war game, and there's a completely separate team of judges that does all the mechanics and then reports what the results of your last move was. So the most difficult time is when control reports the results of damage assessment, especially when those results differ significantly from player expectations. So for example, if an airstrike against enemy shore targets results in extraordinarily high losses to your aircraft, the players too often complain about the quality of the models used to produce the outcome, or sometimes they complain about the lineage of the damage assessor, instead of inquiring about the possible operational explanations for why the losses were so high. And then the next page, he says, this is a point where, unfortunately, the judges frequently break character and start, screenshot I have here. Unfortunately, this particular point is where the judges frequently break character and then start talking mechanics about why what I would call this black swan event occurred, defending the mechanics of the system. And now both sides are talking mechanics and rules, and the spell is broken, is what he says. Which is interesting terminology itself. So in summary, I think, Paul, to your question about, is it okay for the players to roll the dice, right? Even if the players, if I have a table and the players don't see it, by putting the dice in their hands, right, they're aware that they rolled on one end of the continuum or not. And if I at least say, look, higher is better and lower is worse, or vice versa, as we've said kind of before, they see that it actually happened. They see that I didn't make it up to screw them. And they also kind of psychologically take responsibility for it, even though it's obviously totally random. So I think that takes off, by having the players roll the dice, that takes away this particular issue of the players starting to debate about a black swan issue, because it actually was in their hands. They see that the weird dice roll came up, and they kind of own the fact that they had a bad luck, stroke of luck there.
I mean, that's okay. So let me unwind that a little bit. Certainly. You know, in terms of like the players seeing the results and knowing that nothing is being faked, right? Like, of course, you could do that by just still having the DM roll the dice, but rolling them publicly so that everyone can see them, which, frankly, is the way it's portrayed in those D&D episodes of Community, as I described, where the DM is always rolling all the dice, but they're rolled publicly and everybody, there's definitely moments where there's like important roll coming up and everyone leans in to look, right? So you still get that drama, which is something we've talked about before, a reason we both like as DMs, even when it is our, when we see it as our responsibility to roll the dice, that we still want to you know, do so in the open for everyone to see. But I think you kind of hit the nail on the head when you were talking about, but also they take that kind of, how did you put it? They're an emotional...
psychological responsibility is what I said.
Psychological responsibility. Yeah, that is fascinating, right?
Right.
And I've seen that so many times. I've seen that in cases where, like, I've had games where a big role is going to come up and I'm like, okay, well, you know, this, you know, if I describe the stakes, right? If this happens, you know, mm-hmm. and we fail this role, you know, the floor falls out from under you and you collapse into a pit and you're most likely going to be dead, right? And then I get ready to roll the die and everybody's like, the tension is high. And I go, you know what? I'm going to have you roll it. And
exactly.
I've had players cringe in that moment of going, oh no, I don't want to be responsible for this,
yes!
right? Like,
yes.
I don't want to roll it.
A thousand times this. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm tweaking as I go forward, you know, I'm making judgments and I really didn't mean to do this, but I wind up having an expanding house rules document. And, mm-hmm. you know, one of the things that happened last time is for the first time my players got their hands on some grenades and started using them. And so I'm like, okay, we're going to find out what the grenade rule is right now. And I looked it up and I'm like, that's not great. I mean, that's not great. And I realized that it had been gauged to a particular map, to a particular scale that based on how far you're throwing it, it always misses by exactly the same amount. And I'm like, that's weird. I want a mechanic that has some variation for how much further or how much shorter or where it lands, it's reasonable. And I wrote, you know, a modified rule. And then I was specifically thinking about, you know, that's not great if I have the player roll it. That's actually, I can do that, but it's a little bit too complicated. And I very specifically tweaked the rule, thinking about what's going to be convenient to put on the player's end so that when they miss their grenade throw and then have to roll for where it lands by accident, you know, the fact that there's at least a small chance they blow themselves up is going to be in their hands. And I specifically tweaked the rule to make it digestible for the player when that happens, because I thought of one thing and I'm like, well, I really don't want the effect to be coming out of my hand. I want them to be blaming themselves for it. And I modified the rules in order to support that.
Nice. Now, I want to go back a little bit to some of the stuff you're discussing from the book, where you got into sort of the difference between command and control and the prediction of the author that we were going to see stuff move more into the control area, which was going to make sales difficult, I guess. Is that the point of this book? Is this book trying to describe like how to make a successful war game for marketability? Is that often a direction it's going in?
A small amount of the time. A very small amount of the time. And you know what? There's even a bit of a moral struggle, a tiny little bit of a moral question about me even reading the book, actually, because, you know, Pearl is certainly writing from a perspective. He was working at the Navy as a consultant, mm-hmm. specifically on, you know, wargaming for real world defense purposes. That's actually his main thrust. So most of the time, he talks about that. And the really weird thing, there's this one weird piece of terminology that for me kind of feels backwards, is that the people working at the Navy in the Defense Department who are specifically not going to be selling the war game designs, he calls professionals. And the people that are designing and selling war games at Avalon Hill or SSI or whatever, he calls them hobbyists. So the people that are selling are hobbyists, and the people that aren't are professionals, which to me feels backwards. But probably like 75% of the time, he's talking about how can we use this for actual defense training and education and analysis purposes.
Interesting.
And then occasionally he goes, but you know what? The hobbyists have really good ideas that we should use more often.
Okay. But it's generally his audience is assumed to be a military one. That's fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting. Right. So the whole thing, the interesting thing that struck me about that whole sequence there is that I feel like when trying to talk to someone about the difference between like command and control, where my brain always goes is to a style of game that came out just a few years after this book was written, and it goes the complete opposite direction and emphasizes command, which is real-time strategy video games, right? You see RTS is coming out in the mid to late 90s, right? Things like Command & Conquer or StarCraft or whatnot. And the thing I always remember about those games, right, it's very easy to explain command to someone with that game as a reference. Say, well, you select all the guys and you tell them to go here, and they kind of do, right? And then what do they do when they're left there on their own? They do what they want to do, right? They might get distracted. They might be on their way to where you told them to go and get attacked, and then they might go fight, right? Like, they don't do precise... You're not controlling every individual guy in that game. In fact, most of that game, especially at the higher levels of those types of games, is you frantically scrolling around the map to say, oh, this group go do that, and then I'm going to go change my attention over here, and this group go do that, right? And just hope that they're doing roughly what you told them to do.
That is really interesting, Paul, because I was also thinking about StarCraft, which I did play quite a bit of at one point. And I actually had the opposite take. I mean, you're very quickly persuading me to your viewpoint. I actually had the exact opposite take that StarCraft is I would have actually said is much more of a control type thing, because you are grabbing stuff at a very low level. And if you want to, you can grab individual units, individual pieces, and specifically take control of them. And certainly if you grab some units and point at a destination, they are going there. They're not making a different decision about where to go. But you're right that a lot of the lower level, what they shoot at, what they move at, by default is being automated. I think that
you're right that you can get in there and you can take fine-tuned control and you can override, right? You can be like, no, I said go here, right? I feel like a lot of that game is that frustrated, like, what are you doing, stupid Marine, go here, right? Right, but of course that immediately evokes for me that sense of like, I feel like I'm in the general's shoes, right, at that point. I am the general who's like, all right, drop me in place with this group of Marines, and I'm going to bark at them until they do exactly what I told them to do, right? Yes, I can control this one specific tank and tell it exactly where to go by getting in the tank and taking the steering wheel and saying, no, we're going here, right? And then I'm ignoring the whole rest of the battlefield because I, as a general, decided to take over.
Listen to what Paul said. Don't listen to what I said. Do that instead.
So I'm glad at least that, like, and so the interesting thing is, right, I think that there is, this is a kind of a direction I was hoping this conversation might eventually stray, is that as the rules become more and more complex, I do think it's very interesting to see systems that start to take the implementation of those rules out of everyone's hands and give them to a computer.
Right. And, Perla, for what it's worth, is writing right at the moment where that's becoming possible for hobby gamers.
Yep.
And he's seen it. He's seen computerized wargaming studios, I'll say, in one location in the Navy. And it's just starting to become available as he writes. And he's like, oh, here's it. And you know what the next step is? We might network them. We might possibly have more than one computer talking to each other, like from a distance, possibly. Oh, think about the possibilities there. And, I certainly remember, I think it was probably 89, 90, when my friends that had Macs got this networked war game. I think it was called Strategic Conquest, I think, if my memory serves right. And that, I got to, if you've grown up with the internet, that was mind-blowing. It was mind-blowing that we could have, a war game and have all the mechanics taken care of by the computer, two people only seeing what your side is aware of, right? So you've got the fog of war all taken care of, and just it being just smooth and everything that you kind of always wanted out of a war game. And I remember, I think it was that summer, like after maybe my freshman year of college or something like that, and my high school friends got together and we stayed up, I believe, for 2 days straight playing the first networked war game that we ever had, and just Yeah. Sun went down, sun came up, just continually looping players in for the next cycle. And I thought it was the best thing ever. So you're right, Paul, computer gaming really took off.
I've had that experience myself. And the funny thing is I can't help but point out that it also sounds a lot like the early experiences written about by people who discovered D&D for the first time when it first came out. Is that they just played,
right?
And played, and right. It became this obsessive thing.
Right,
that's great.
Right,
that's great.
Now I'll say that Pearl observes this, right? And then maybe he's right or maybe he's wrong, but he makes the point where this is going to open up so many possibilities for wargaming. But he comes back to the emphasis of why are we doing this specifically for human communication. The whole point of war games, the goal is to practice and explore human decision making and what it feels like to be in the boots in these situations, including human time constraints in your decision making. And he says that both, practically and philosophically, you've got to still have two human players. You still have to have humans on either side to feel what it's like to be in contention with another human psychology. And I think that for us who are, role-playing gamers, you still want a referee specifically for all the stuff that your mechanics never thought of. So for all the ad hoc that your player comes up with, I want to try something completely crazy. And this goes all the way back to David Wesley. I want to do something completely crazy. There's a human operator there that can step in and say, I'm going to handle this. I'm going to make a reasonable judgment about this thing that we never considered before. And there's a human player on the other side that can respond to that in a reasonable fashion. And if we were to entirely remove the human element from any one of those aspects, we'd really lose the whole point about why we're doing this.
Interesting. I mean, there's an argument to be made about what about the rise of AI, Dan? Isn't the hope that someday I can play D&D with an AI and it will just be my DM and make all the stuff up for me, and eventually I just go on the holodeck and play out all my fantasies?
There are days, Paul, where I worry that, I still have paper books. I still like paper books. So, maybe everything is going to change because of AI. Hmm. Maybe how we live, work, entertain ourselves. Maybe, or maybe not. Maybe we're talking at the moment of a spike in hype, possibly.
To get back to what I was getting at with the automation of stuff with computers, I feel like this is an area that we haven't seen enough development in, that I'm actually really curious and anxious to see, what additional sort of computer augmented DMing can we add into the game of roleplay? I think that's really interesting to me. I get a little taste of it when we played, and we played this on stream. You can go watch it, viewers, when we played Return to Dark Tower, where there's a computer program running, it's a cooperative board game, and there's a computer program running the back end of it and making things happen. And it's fascinating because, right, like at the end of each turn, right, we do a cycle of all our turns, or actually at the end of each individual's turn, like events happen. There's a section where you say, okay, I'm done with my turn. You drop a skull in the tower, and then the program says, this stuff happens. And at the beginning, it feels very arbitrary. Like the first couple of games I played of it, it's like, it's just making stuff up. What is this nonsense? And then eventually I got to get a feel for it. I go, oh no, I see. It depends on what the main quest is and which adversary we're playing with. And the combination of that causes these kinds of events to happen. That said, I'm not totally sure of, like, do I like it more this way, where it just like feels like random stuff happens between each turn? Or would it be nice to see the die roll, to see the, like, here's a big chart of stuff that could happen to you, right? We rolled a number. The answer is this thing happened.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. I'm honestly not sure. Like, there's a nice thing of that it takes some of the complexity away from me, so I don't even have to worry about it. But on the other hand, it does start to feel a little arbitrary as well.
You know, I still, for what it's worth, I'm still, you know, telling my players like what the chances of an encounter are when I roll the die. And then, you know, depending, and then some players are like, oh no. And they're like, oh crap, Dan. Yeah, but I'm not, you know, I think that the moment I think I would maybe narratively inform them about what the, you know, what might pop up, but the specific tales of what it is going to pop up, that's still hidden at the moment.
Yeah. And frankly, I will say, Return to Dark Tower does this, but it takes several plays of the game for you to figure it out that like each of the enemies that are right at the beginning of the game, you determine what kinds of enemies are even going to be in the game. And you have cards for them. And if you look at the cards, it does say like these are the kinds of things that tend to happen when this enemy is around. And it doesn't really, it doesn't tell you explicitly. It doesn't tell you how or when. It just says, you know, dragons like to destroy buildings. That happens. Deal with it.
Okay. I think this is possibly really tasteful. And I think part of what you're touching on right now, Paul, is another thing I want to talk about is that, you know, when I first started playing D&D, both for me and my players, you know, and I'm rediscovering this with my Star Frontiers game, is that exploration of the rules itself is part of the game. Is we go into an encounter or a dungeon and we're not entirely sure how it is going to work out. I'm not entirely, my player threw a grenade on Friday. I'm like, I don't know how that works. We're going to find out right now. And obviously next time it happens, both sides will be more aware about what the chances are, what the risks are, things like that. Mm-hmm. And the exploration of a new world itself is part of the play. You know, the rules of the new world are themselves part of the play.
Interesting.
I like that. I feel it gives a whole additional layer to your play, and you know, scouting out and being smart about what the risks and the rewards are in particular situations, I feel itself is like gives a whole different dimension to the role playing, and I think I kind of like that too.
Interesting. I can't help but feel that you're going to land in this cycle though, where you know, players start to get used to the rules and figure it out.
Yeah.
And it starts to feel rote. The same things are always happening. And now we got to change it up. So now we're going to add more stuff. And
I don't disagree. You know? I'm a little concerned about that. Or you know, here, new monsters, right? Here come the new monsters. And, oh, you didn't see the ear seeker coming, did you? You didn't think about the rot grub. Right. Or the disenchanter monster that takes away your magic items. The beholder with the dispel magic, eye beam, stuff like that. I do worry you might get possibly in a similar cycle to that actually, or you know maybe that's an argument for I don't want to do it quickly myself, or you know once in a while switching to a different system. You might consider that even if you know as much as I adore you know D&D and it's what I'm always going to come back to. I don't mind switching it up and just recalling what it's like to have a new system that's surprising to me and my players and kind of rediscover what that's like. So you might consider having, you know, maybe over the summer, have like a short-term campaign with your players for you DMs out there and just, you know, just totally switch it up with a totally different system and see how that feels to you.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I feel like, especially with D&D, like you have to, right? The only way you could do this with D&D is to go out and find a group of players who had simply never played before, right? Which is not possible.
Yeah,
I've been in that plenty of times, much more easy probably is to just get your normal group of players together and say, well, let's explore this different game. And I think there is, and frankly, I feel like it does lower the bar of resistance to doing that when you say. And you don't have to worry about the rules. You don't have to read anything ahead. You don't have. There's no background stuff for you. Don't worry about it. I'll just run it. It'll be fine. I think that's nice. It's nice. I kind of want to do it, Dan. Kind of want to do it. I got to find myself a system.
Right? Or make one up. Right? Make you know this. Here's your opportunity to make up a new system, and you know develop it on the fly. As the play happens, respond to the players with, you know, judgments and maybe evolve your own personal game system on the fly and see what the needs are, and see how that would develop. Actually, I think would be an interesting experiment. It's really been very refreshing to me, and I really feel like I'm kind of gaming for the first time all over again, which is a nice
neat
rediscovery.
That's very cool.
Yeah,
it's very cool. Yeah. And how are the players reacting? Are they enjoying the obscurity of it?
I think pretty well. I haven't done a formal survey, and so a little bit in both directions. It's been like, I don't know how this is going to work, and asking me. But I do think as far as just time on task, we're just talking about stuff in the world more than we're talking about mechanical stuff. And sometimes I say, well, I'll just take care of that. Again, the system's very simple. I can say, they'll say, what happens if I get another level in this skill? And I go, everything you're doing goes up by 10%. That's it. That's all it ever is. At this point, they do know the mechanics for how the base chance to hit is computed. They're asking about that. They're computing it on their sheets. They have their ability scores. And most of the time in this game, it's just roll under that ability score. So they get that. Mm-hmm. They're tracking their stamina, right? They're tracking their health. So they know how damaged they're getting and things like that. But all the modifiers, range, movement, speed, cover, this, that, the other thing, no one has really demanded. I guess for the first time on Friday, someone asked like what the range modifiers were, I guess. but in general, I think that, again, most of the time we're talking about stuff in the world from the perspective of the characters and less in the mechanics. And I that just feels pretty good to me right at the moment. Maybe next week I'll come back and I'll say different. But right at the moment, it's feeling really good like that.
Yeah. I mean, I will say as a player, that's my favorite thing, especially when encountering a new system, is to say, I don't want to read any of the rules up front. I don't want to, I just want to like sit back and absorb and enjoy the game and just embody the character that I've made and get to know the world. That's fascinating.
And it's a point that, and again, Perla is talking from a wargaming perspective and trying to actually prepare actual military officers for command. But late in the book, he keeps coming back a number of times, this idea that the more that the information is feeding into your actual roles decisions, the better. And the more that the player is responding to artificial game mechanics. And so I guess there's a point where he says, he's actually talking about, there's a point where he takes on the whole playability versus realism axis, which is traditionally the wargamer's debate. And there's a point where he says, if you don't realize that you can have both of these things. And what he says is, I think when people talk about that, they're really talking about the balance between the game system and the player. He says game designers too often fail to consider what the role of the player is. And again, he's talking about war games here. And he says the critical point is reached when making the system work demands too much artificial behavior from the player. Each added artificiality distorts the player's perceptions of and psychological reactions to the reality that the game is trying to recreate. And that, boy, that really hits me really well at the moment, that every single time you're thinking about or talking about some artificial game mechanic is a moment that you've been taken away from the in-game psychology of your character. And that, this seems important for me to read at this point in my gaming life.
Interesting. Yeah, I can see that. Dan, we are getting close here to being out of time. So I think I'm gonna ask now. What are your final thoughts on hiding the rules from your players?
It's funny that I'm discovering it accidentally at my game table, and I'm discovering it accidentally in a book that was supposed to be about wargaming, like on the same weekend even. And at the moment, I am finding that having the players, like having the load of the mechanical rules on the referee's side, can add to immersion, can give extra flexibility to the GM to make judgments, to adjust to circumstances. I think it's reasonable for the players to have some simple stats to their characters. I think I'm still solid on having the dice in the players' hands so that they're actually taking responsibility when the Black Swan events show up in combat and things like that. But in general, yeah, the less mechanics, the less skills on their sheets and stuff like that, the more the immersion is happening and the more we're getting into these characters' perspectives and existences and challenges and decisions. And at the moment, it's you know, it's all plus 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 for me right at the moment. I think DM should try this, right? Either add it to your game, pick up a completely different system, write your own little minimal system. Just try it. I wasn't going to do it in my long running D&D campaign, but just try it for a couple sessions. And similar, Paul, when you and I started rolling all of our dice in the open. You might discover really good texture to your gameplay. And I do think it's something that I'm going to add more of in my games going forward.
It's fascinating to me that you've kind of stumbled onto this by accident. Like I always say that like every game is an experiment, and certainly every time I've set up a campaign, it's usually with some preconceived idea of, I want to try this. I want to try this new idea. And it's just very amusing to me that you're kind of doing that, but by accident, that's not what you set out to do, right? You just set out to play some Star Frontiers because you love Star Frontiers.
Absolutely.
So that's, and it just so happens that Dan takes delight in gathering players to play in obscure games that only he's ever heard of.
Oof! Ooh, right in the solar plexus. Oof!
But it's great. It's a great experience, and I think, and it's fascinating. And I think I would like to try it as well. And that's that. Yeah, and I'll definitely add that to my list of things. And it's not like it's not completely unfounded. Honestly, there's little doses of this everywhere. If you just look at how you're playing D&D, you'll find little doses of this. Right, little things like finding secret doors, or you know, whatever. I remember very distinctly reading this trope in at least one, if not two, modules of in the adventure text, encouraging you to be like, DM, just grab a bunch of dice and roll them at this point, and like shake your head and go, oh no, that's not good, right? Which is just a ridiculous psychological thing, but it's implying in that direction of like there are things going on, there are rules being implemented that only you as DM are privy to, and that's good, and that adds dramatic tension to the game. So I'm fascinated by this idea, and I definitely feel like there's pros and cons, and I suspect if I try it out, I'm not going to just be immediately, you know, throwing out all of every way I've ever played and saying like, this is 100% the way to do it, but I think it'll be a fun experience. So I'm going to try it.
And I will say that, you know, the danger is going to be when something bad happens to a player and they dispute it. And this has happened to me. Pearl has seen it in the Navy. This is the point where I, as the judge, feel like I need to defend myself. And I start talking about the mechanics at that point. And now the mechanics have been revealed. And you can't go back from that point. And so there might be this bit of a slippery slope whereby there might be a day where to defend yourself, you wind up, you know, exposing this stuff. And we'll see. I don't know. Maybe there's no solution. Maybe that's just direction things always going.
And that's why I'm excited by the idea of automation for this stuff. Like I would love to be able to say like, well, the computer said so. That's why. Why did you fail at this thing? I don't know. I pressed the button. Computer says no.
You know,
it's not in my hand.
Paul, how many of our friends would say, well, that program is buggy? I want to see the code. I want to do a code review, Paul. Code review coming in, incoming.
Viewers, if you have any experience playing games where the players are unaware of the rules of the game that they are playing, or any experience doing so in a role-playing game, pro or con, we'd love to hear from you. Leave us a comment in the YouTube chat here, and tell us about your experience, and maybe that will inform our future discussions about this topic, which I'm sure there will be several more.
I hope so myself. Remember, you can like, follow, and subscribe to us. We're on YouTube, Twitch, Facebook, GitHub, places like that. We have the handle Wandering DMs on all those sites. So please look for us there and bury that like button.
If you prefer to listen to our show in audio-only podcast format, you can find those podcasts at our website at wanderingdms.com. Also through various podcast carriers such as iTunes and Spotify and Stitcher. If you're listening to this show right now on one of those third-party sites and they offer the ability to do so, please rate and review our show. That helps other users of that site find us, and we really appreciate it.
We absolutely do. And of course, big thanks to our patrons who support the show here. If you'd like to join them, please visit patreon.com/wanderingdms. And just like Paul said at the top of the show, every single tier gets you access to our private Discord server. Conversations are continuing round the clock all week long. And we will be there in about 10 minutes to continue this conversation in our weekly after chat. So we really hope that you'll be on our Discord server, and we would love to see you there. I'll be back this Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern time for more of Dan's Old Time Mini Show. And I have been doing a whole series where I've been duplicating old school miniatures in lead specifically for my Star Frontiers campaign. And at the moment, I'm actually making molds finally for the villains of Star Frontiers, the sinister, slimy, awful giant space worms called the Sather. And you know what? I'll point out a really key part of that campaign is that somehow the Sather get a bunch of saboteurs of the other races to do their dirty work for them. And it's a secret about how they do that. How do the Sather convince all the good people to do all these sabotage jobs? That is actually a secret in the campaign. I don't know. Maybe I'll be talking about that on Thursday when I'm making molds for them. I don't know, Paul. But I'm Excellent. Not telling you now. You'll have to tune in, kids.
Looking forward to it.
So look for that Thursday, 9 p.m. Eastern time. And of course, Paul and I, we are live here every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. So please join us again next week for another thought-provoking discussion.
We'll see you then.